Law firms using Leap Legal software enjoy all the benefits of a state-of-the-art practice management system, as well as legal accounting, document assembly and management, and legal publishing assets, all in one integrated solution. A trusted partner of more than 60,000 lawyers, Leap helps you provide outstanding legal services to your clients and allows you to run a productive and profitable law firm. Leap, the legal practice productivity solution. Learn more, visit leap.com.au. This is a Momentum Media production.
The Protégé Podcast. Your fortnightly look into the biggest things happening in the legal profession for the next generation of lawyers.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Protégé Podcast. This is Lawyers Weekly's stream for law students, graduates and junior lawyers right across the country to help them move up the ranks in their legal careers. My name's Jerome Dorasamy, and today I have two guests. One's a return guest, James Dapici. He's a director at Chamberlain's Law Firm. James, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jerome. Very kind.
We've also got Hugh Smith, and he's a senior associate at Chamberlain's. Hugh, welcome for your first appearance on the show.
Thank you, Jerome. Very excited. I'm very glad you can have me.
Now, today we're going to be talking about what constitutes good advocacy for junior lawyers. So this is obviously a hugely important conversation for the professional development of those coming through the ranks, how to be a good advocate, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what are some of the lessons that those who've been there, done that, have learned in their own vocational journeys, and what else you need to know moving forward in this period of ongoing turbulence and uncertainty in the post-pandemic landscape. Hugh, before we get into all things advocacy, you haven't been on the show before, whereas James has. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your career to date.
Thanks, Jerome. So I started off as a junior baby lawyer at Chamberlain's about 6 years ago, and I've been at Chamberlain's ever since. And for my first few years, I did lots of directions hearings without much guidance, which is how it normally goes. And from there, in the last few years especially, I'm running cases, especially for insolvency matters, by myself in the federal court before judges and registrars. So I've gone through from the bottom to where I am now in terms of the advocacy space. And at the moment, I'm based in the Canberra office and broadly head up the commercial litigation division here and run lots of cases here in New South Wales and in the federal court.
Started at the bottom, now you're here, huh?
Exactly.
And tell me, what is it about advocacy or being a legal advocate that has been, you know, really motivating for you? And why was this the direction that you wanted to go in?
Yes, that's a good question. I see it as the purest form of lawyering. You know, you join as a lawyer and most people have aspirations to go to court or at least think about it in their minds. So the second that I got the option to go to a return of subpoena or a directions hearing, I jumped at the chance. And since then, I quite enjoy it. I'm lucky that the thing that I'm probably best at is advocacy. So if you can do something that you're good at, you might as well keep doing it. And that's why I've kept down this path. So that's the reason that I enjoy it as much as I do.
James, I want to bring you in here. You just described advocacy as the purest form of lawyering, and I really like that. Is that how you see it as well?
As someone who does less and less work on my feet, Jerome, as time passes, I think the answer must be yes. It's interesting because as you look at, and I know many listeners of the Protégé podcast might be earlier on in their journeys through the legal profession than this old soul may be, but I think, yes, there's a degree of sharpness, the degree of immediacy, and, you know, a great many lawyers come to this profession because we have a competitive edge and we like outcomes. And I think the degree of pitting your position, however you want to put it, against the position of someone else, and then finding out who, you know, who was right at the end, I think there's a real appeal to that. But I think I should just qualify my comment by saying, when we say advocacy, I'm talking very much sort of solicitor advocacy, so low-level stuff. I'm not standing up here running hearings. I'm standing up here occasionally wandering off to court to do some solicitor-type things. So I don't speak with profound knowledge, but I just speak with wistful warmth for those times when I get to be on my feet.
Absolutely. Now, in talking about the virtues of advocacy and how best to be a good advocate, is probably worth painting a picture for those listening as to what it feels like to be up there advocating for your client and trying to put forward the best case possible. So I'm curious to know if both of you would be willing to share what it feels like, perhaps on an emotional or visceral level, to be an advocate.
I'd say first and foremost, terrifying. As James said, you're getting your argument put against an independent arbiter and you're finding out if you're right or not at the end of the day. And sometimes you can be in the wrong, sometimes you're in the right. But first and foremost, I think, especially for junior lawyers and even for senior practitioners, there's a degree of terror involved in every appearance in case you'd forgotten something. But at the same time, it's also, exhilarating at the same time. You get to put your money where your mouth is, practice what you preach, and tell the court exactly what you've been telling your client. And maybe your client's in the room or in the courtroom watching you, maybe not, but you get to really tough it out, and it's an immediate. So you're scared before you get there. You're scared during the time where you're doing your advocacy, but you've also prepared and you have your notes ready to go. And at the end of it, you get to see whether you're right or not. So it's the full service of feelings as a lawyer in the space of a very short period of time.
For me, it's the terror, Jerome, just that a lot of people feel nerves in different ways. And I'm sure there's some touchy-feely line that one of you will be able to put your hands on about, if you're not doing stuff that scares you, then you might be in the wrong profession or whatever it is. It's that feeling of doing something important. It's that feeling of bringing whatever preparation you've done, and it might be just a career's worth of preparation because something urgent has to happen right now and counsel is somewhere else. And that happened to me about 4 working hours ago. So it's sort of springing fresh in my mind, and His Honour was pretty unimpressed with the application I brought without notice. So that one springs to mind. But it's the combination of the sort of nerves of doing something important that might go wrong versus trying to sort of take a little bit of pride and a little bit of confidence in the prep work you've done as well. And if you can sort of balance that fear and that sort of humble confidence, then I think that's kind of the way to go about it.
Definitely. Well, there's a lot to pick up on from what both of you have said, and we're going to get to all of that on the other side of this.
In-house counsel, Lawyers Weekly, is on the lookout for the best and brightest in the industry. The Lawyers Weekly Corporate Counsel Awards is now taking submissions and nominations for 2023, pinpointing innovation, excellence, and resilience throughout multiple category options. The awards leave no stone unturned to find the hidden gems of the in-house legal industry. Get involved this year by either submitting or nominating a colleague or team by visiting corporatecounselawards.com.au.
Now, Hugh, we're having this conversation today because I came across on LinkedIn a guide that yourself and James have written about how to be a good advocate, or how junior lawyers can be good advocates. And I thought I would reach out because I had a quick flick through it and thought there was some really pertinent, tangible guidance for the next generation of lawyers. So before we get into what's in that guide, tell me a bit about it and why it was important for the two of you to put this one together.
Yes, thanks, Jerome. I'm grateful for James's assistance as well. It's very much a joint effort. The reason we put it together is to give back a little bit, although that's a bit cliched, but it's hard for junior lawyers coming through. Some people get guidance, some don't. And from both of our own experiences, it would have been nice to have a paper like this to read through just to make sure you're on the right track, a bit of a sanity check. So it was about giving back a little bit, but also training juniors within the firm as well with respect to what we expect when we tell them to go to court. So if you have 2 weeks to get ready for a directions hearing, this paper sets out essentially what we expect to be done. And provided that's done, that's all you can ask of anyone.
Mm. Yeah, there's the touchy-feely balanced with the fairly cold and calculated, Jerome. I think that they are skills that we'd like to equip our team with in order to make money and do good work for our clients. And they're also skills where, as part of a collegiate profession, very happy to sort of talk about publicly. There's a Madeleine Albright line of there's a special place in hell for those that pull the ladder up after them, or whatever that line might be. It's quite easy for Hugh and I to, you know, and others who have experience to say, oh, well, we've done it now, ha ha, best of luck. I think that's not an approach that's good for the profession. And look, as I say, it's not an approach that's good for the business we're trying to run here. And it's not an approach that's good for trying to bring new, excited young people into that business. So there's that calculated element. And I should say that Hugh's kind to give me credit. This evolved out of a chat I had at another firm with someone called Sanjay Selvakumaran, who's at Wipol Lawyers, who's great as well. So I've got to tip my proverbial cap to Sanjay as well.
Well, James, as a self-identified Slytherin, you're no doubt familiar with the cold and calculated.
Very, very much so. We're a misunderstood house, Jerome. Misunderstood.
But I am keen to dive into that aspect of this broader conversation a little bit, because I think for, you know, a lot of the students, grads, you know, younger lawyers listening to this, when they think about good advocacy, they may largely think of, I guess, what you could crudely term the good aspects of it, the sort of noble, the virtuous sides of being an advocate. But as you rightly say, there are other elements that go into shaping, you know, the holistic person that is an advocate. So could you guys sort of dive into those, I guess, those more calculating angles or aspects that really need to be tapped into?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first one, which is no surprise, is prepare. What that means, though, in practice is read your case. So if you're at the point where you added late directions hearing, you should at least, as a junior lawyer, go into, say, a directions hearing, know what the pleadings say, read the statement of claim, read the defence, and know what the main issues are. So if it's a breach of contract claim, know what the term is, what the alleged breach is, and whether or not it's defended. And if it is defended or denied, know exactly what that is and what evidence you'd need to put on or what evidence is on. So read your pleadings first to know what the case is about, because often as a junior lawyer, you're not going to have much of an idea. Your senior might throw you under the bus and say, off you go, get to court in 2 days' time and get me these orders. So read the pleadings so at least you know what's going on. And then the other thing is most of the work for a lot of solicitor advocacy is done before you're actually before the court. So what I do and what most lawyers should do is at least prepare draft orders. They could be called short minutes or they could be called draft consent orders. It really doesn't matter. And get them to the other side as early as you possibly can. So if it's 2 days before, great. If it's 12 hours before, fine. If it's that morning, so be it. And see what their response is. Often if you send it 2 days beforehand, you'll get a response saying, no, that's dumb. We need an extra week here. You know, we need an extra 6 months. We disagree with the entire timetable. So at least you can frame your argument before you get to court, and you can bring those emails to court as well, hand them up, and that's your job done for you as well. So you know your pleadings, you know what orders you're seeking and what orders they want. And then the other things you need to know is the law to an extent. Take that with a grain of salt because you're never going to know it that well as a junior lawyer. You're never going to know it as well as you want to. But my tip is, I would always print off the relevant UCPR rules or court procedure rules in the ACT. I'd read them and I'd take them to court and I'd take copies to court as well. So, for example, if you're appearing in a return of subpoena, print off the rules around what the usual orders are. So at least when the registrar says, do you want the usual orders, Mr. Smith? My answer is yes. I've read it and I have the thing before me. And if they want to depart from the usual orders, at least I know why it's being departed from or what the usual orders are and what the expectations are around that. So step one is prepare, regardless of how early or how late you get notice. James?
Yes. And if we're thinking of the less noble approaches to advocacy, my Slytherin answer is that the only question I really have running through my head is, what can I do to increase the likelihood that the decision is going to come down my way? And so if we think about prepare, it might be dealing with my opponent ahead of time in a certain way. Sorry, opponent is not an ideal word to use it. Dealing with the other side.
Learned colleague.
Precisely so.
Learned friend. Sorry,
Yes. Precisely so, and very well put by you, Jerome, I accept that. But it's always the path to what is most likely to lead to the outcome I want. And so often that will be best practice type preparation of the kind Hugh has just set out. And from time to time, it will be perhaps the more EQ softer type elements of knowing what a certain judicial officer did on the previous occasion or will normally say to an advocate who says the sort of things that you're about to say. So I think the balance of that sort of IQ, technical mastery and you know, command over the matter versus a sort of EQ, reading the room, making sure your opponent's as close to the position you would like them in as possible is the way to go about it. And if I can just add one comment to build on the metaphor Hugh uses there, a number of listeners to the Protégé podcast might be in those very early years where they might be a little bit scared of being thrown under the bus. The metaphor that I certainly like and that I think Hugh enjoys is about trying to score a try from a hospital pass is kind of the line of, you know, trying to do your best to sort of look out for when your partner might have a number of things on and, ooh, there's something in her diary tomorrow that she might have forgotten. And so you might be there at 10 minutes to nine, she might say to you, oh, no, can you please run off and do this? And you might be able to say, well, actually, I had a look at that file last night. Yeah, I'd be delighted. It looks like we're looking for these orders. Is that right? And what's funny about impressing your partner is that it'll make them more likely, well, it'll make them more likely to give you more work in future, but it'll make them more likely to think highly of your conduct as well. So it's a good opportunity for you to build your practice, even at a junior level.
I'm curious to dive into a minor point you made there, James, about the importance of adopting the mindset of, you know, what can I do to gain the competitive edge, you know, over my opponent, you know, my learned friend. Obviously, competitiveness is a personality trait that is, you know, quite common among lawyers. And it's one that, you know, a lot of our listeners will be aware is one that can and will have deleterious impacts upon one's, you know, holistic health and well-being. You know, we can really tap into some negative traits that lawyers have and exacerbate their stress, anxiety, potentially even depression. So I'm curious to know from both of your experiences, you know, how best can you balance the professional utility in being, you know, a bit more competitive when you need to be a good advocate versus the need to look after yourself on more of an emotional level?
I've got a fairly settled view, and that's that being competitive is light years away from being mean or cruel or discourteous or even, you know, distant or dispassionate. My competitive edge comes from hopefully being reasonable as a technical practitioner, but from having good, healthy, civil, and sometimes quite warm relationships with people on the other side of matters. So competitiveness is not to be construed as banging on the bar table, yelling, taking silly little technical points, sending emails at 11:30 p.m. at night, ambushing people. None of that is particularly impressive. And if you're a competitive person, none of that's really advancing your and your client's interests. So it's just making you look like a bit of an idiot. The opponents who I think I find most intimidating and most impressive and who are the most effective in the competition, if we're talking about competitiveness, are very civil, are very polite, are very respectful, are very responsive. And they're the sort of opponents who you'll finish a matter and lose perhaps, and then end up being very happy to grab a glass of wine or a cup of coffee with afterwards. And when we talk about competitiveness, it's about a decade-long career where you want to preserve your own mental health and the mental health of others in your profession. And if you're the sort of person who looks at trying to pick apart the what we might call broader mental health sort of questions of your opponent, then, you know, word spreads and it's a pretty bad, you know, if you're competitive, that's a good way to lose the competition. And I think that competitiveness must form part of your strategy of being as warm, civil, collegiate, friendly, open, responsive as you can to other members of the profession. If you're failing to do that, then whatever competition you claim to be winning isn't really worth entering as far as I'm concerned.
And you're always going to get those practitioners that are mean and nasty and make your life painful whenever you have a matter against them. So to pick up on what James said, to the extent you can be nice and have a good relationship with your opponent, you should embrace it, because it's nice to go to court and not have to deal with that worry about, you know, someone trying to, you know, throw you under the bus in front of a judge or say something that's not quite true. You're better off having an open, honest fight with someone that you respect and like than fighting 24/7, because it's not sustainable in this profession.
There's also an element of cold strategy of I want someone on the other side to be able to say, hey, James told me this.
Yeah.
I know him. He's a pretty trustworthy guy. And if he tells me this, then I believe him. And so I almost, you know, in Slytherin style, want to get in, you know, to the relationship that the other side has with the client on the other side as well for, you know, the work I've done investing in a relationship and building trust and that they've done with me to really progress things. Because it also assists me to be able to say, hey, Jerome told me this. I know Jerome and he wouldn't tell me this if it wasn't true. And that assists you, Jerome, in your work with your clients and me and my work with mine. And I think it assists the profession more broadly as well, reflects well on all of us.
Well, it sounds like quite the balancing act that needs to be struck in order to be a good advocate. So I'm keen to explore that a little bit further and we'll do that on the other side of this. So, Hugh, further to what we've been discussing, you know, some of the key skills and lessons that new advocates must learn, are there any other really non-negotiable or fundamental skills that really must be gleaned or adopted?
Yes, absolutely. The main thing that the new advocates need to know is the basics. So the basics of appearances, and the only way to really know this is to speak to your senior practitioner or speak to someone who does this from time to time. And an example of that is know which side of the bar table to stand on. So if you're the plaintiff, you're on the left of the bar table as you face a judge. If you're the defendant, you're on the right. Know your introductions. I remember I used to write it down every morning. So may it please the court, my name is Smith and I appear for whoever I appear for. Know when to bow. All of these very simple things really give you a massive head start on others. So if you're up against another junior practitioner and you get to focus on the case at hand and the orders you're proposing, as opposed to, oh, I stood on the wrong side. Oh, I missed this cue. I didn't call this person by the right name. I don't know if this is a registrar before me or a judge. If you can deal with those very basic things, you can really give yourself a leg up and a head start on the others. And those are really the non-negotiables. The other thing that has become non-negotiable in this day and age is online court. So I've done quite a few appearances there now, as many practitioners have. And a non-negotiable on that is, you know, mute yourself when you need to. I honestly think in every single list I go in, even 3 years in after COVID lockdowns and online court, people still don't know how to mute themselves. If you're on a telephone conference, so in the New South Wales subpoena list, it's normally done by telephone, someone will always put themselves on hold and then the entire 40 practitioners in the list will hear hold music for about 10 minutes until they work out, you know, which phone that is and how to mute them. So basic etiquette is non-negotiable and makes your life much easier and also doesn't get you offside with the registrar or judge.
It's a great bit of advice. And to me, it sort of threads together to a broad bit of advice for me. It's just do whatever's likely to make you feel most comfortable. And so often things like knowing your sides of the bar table, knowing your bow when you enters, I often encourage early advocates to try to arrive 10 or 15 minutes early to just sort of get a read of the room, a read of what's going on. To hug the lectern is a bit of advice that I was given that I just stay grateful for. You just hold on to this thing and it automatically puts you into sort of a bit of a stance where you all of a sudden feel a bit more at ease with the world and like you're doing lawyer stuff. So I think, yeah, putting yourself in the position where you're more likely to get the outcome you want. And of course, you know, I'll say, oh, of course, don't put a bag on the bar table. Well, that's not always quite, of course, if you've never done it before and if you were carrying a bag to court anyway. Of course, don't bring a coffee cup in. Well, that's easy, as I say, for Jerome, Hugh and James to say, ha, 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 I saw someone do that. Well, it's almost up to us as senior practitioners to assist those coming through to understand that these things are, well, I guess they go beyond breaches of etiquette, certainly breaches of court practice that ought to be observed.
Hugh, I'm pretty sure I know what the answer to this question is going to be, but you know, you were talking about Zoom etiquette and how best to be an advocate there. You know, given the uptake and mainstreaming of virtual hearings in the age of coronavirus, and certainly that's going to be continuing to some extent in the new normal, are there any sort of fundamentals for what makes a good advocate that are around now that perhaps weren't around pre-pandemic, or have perhaps those pre-pandemic principles simply been reinforced by this new medium that we're advocating in?
It's a very good question. Something that is different in online court definitely is you need to be a bit more prepared, because if you show up to a normal hearing in court or even a directions hearing and you want to tender a document, you can easily just ambush someone and be like, oh, here's this email from 2 weeks ago. Whereas these days, if you intend to do that, you need to email the court like at least an hour beforehand and probably the day before if you really want to rely upon it. So you do have to be a little bit more prepared to tender documents in that regard. The other thing is you lose a bit of the aura of court when you're in Zoom, and a lot of people become a little bit more lackadaisical and they don't enunciate themselves as well as they could. They speak too quickly. Lots of things that can be remedied in a courtroom or don't matter in a courtroom, but it's something that everyone's developing their own style in online court. So, for example, I prefer not to blur my background if I can get away with it, because I find if you have a blurred background for an entire day, it gets a bit jarring having to stare at someone's head while there's blurring moving around. And also having a good setup as well. So make sure that your camera's decent, your microphone's good. Stuff that you know very well, Jerome, but, you know, it's for people that aren't doing it often, you really need to get your basic technology right. And from there, it's almost the same as I said, knowing which side of the bar table to sit in court etiquette. Getting your online etiquette right is just as important as your court etiquette would be when you're in court.
Well, I mean, you've got a very nice pot plant there behind you. So you've certainly got your background sorted. I've just got two more questions for you both. And the first one is, following on, you know, this theme of virtual advocacy that certainly lawyers like yourselves have had to get used to, and those coming through the ranks will also have to get used to. Do you think that those coming through the ranks are perhaps going to have to work a bit harder to ensure that they can be a good advocate in multiple mediums? You know, something that, to be fair, the two of you perhaps wouldn't have had to learn right off the bat because there was only courtroom hearings back in the day.
That's a very good question. I think so, yes, because if you go into the directions list or subpoena list every Monday in court, that becomes, you know, your happy place. You know who the registrar is, you know how the list works, you know who your opponents are. Whereas in online court, it's always a surprise, I find. And so you're not able to ingrain those good habits as much as you'd otherwise like to, and you're chopping and changing between different mediums. So I know that in the Supreme Court of Victoria, they use Zoom. In the federal court, it's Teams. And it's another medium in the New South Wales Supreme Court as well. So it also makes it difficult because you get used to your Zoom functionality and your Teams functionality, and then that changes as well. So there, it is more difficult, and there is certainly more to think about in the background, which distracts you from your primary case, which ends up being quite simple at the end of the day because you know exactly what you want to say. It's just how to say it that becomes the problem. So I absolutely think it is a little bit harder for, you know, young and budding advocates these days.
Definitely. And just finally, for the pair of you, James, I'll start with you and then Hugh can have the final word. Now, reflecting on everything that we've spoken about today, and, you know, for those listening to this episode, are there any other words of wisdom you might want to offer to them, or perhaps put forward an argument? Would you like to advocate for why advocacy is such a meaningful and purposeful pathway for those coming through the ranks?
I'm happy to advocate for that because we often get transactional colleagues who think they do the hard stuff, and I'm very, very happy to go into bat for, you know, having to think on your feet and have your ideas tested in the moment by someone who's pretty smart, pretty switched on, who you may well be friends with and like very much, up against a judicial officer who you may not be friends with and may not like you very much. I say that that's the sharp end of practice. But if I can impart any wisdom, it is that anything I have learned or Hugh has learned has just been through stacking up errors and trying to learn from them and not beat ourselves up too thoroughly about them. Advocacy is scary. The bar table is a scary place, and those transactional colleagues of yours will never know how scary it is. So be kind to yourself. If you walk into the room and you sit down and go, oh, no, I forgot to bow, and if you realise you've been, you know, on your feet for 30 minutes with a coffee cup down near your right hand and you go, oh, no, try to forgive yourself for these little moments and just stack up those little mini errors into, you know, skills that you'll have for the future. Because the only way I was able to contribute to this paper really was by making stacks of errors and trying to remember what they were.
And then in terms of imparting wisdom on my part, what gave my career a real kickstart was being known as the guy that'll go to court for anything. So if there's a hospital pass to be given, I'd put my hand up and say, yep, I'll take it. If there was an easier thing, I'd do it. If there was a hearing and the barrister pulled out and we didn't have a choice, again, I'd put my hand up and be like, well, I'll give it a go. And I think if you're known as that dependable person in your firm as a junior lawyer, then that gives people faith in you, even outside of advocacy. So it's like, oh, Hugh did a good job in this really hard matter. I might as well give him this advice that I need to do urgently because I trust him. And it's a good way to meet different practitioners as well. So you won't always be, you know, stuck with your partner's matter. Another partner might have the same problem and then they'll be talking around and be like, oh, we'll send Hugh or send this person that goes to court all the time. So it's a really valuable skill for a law firm to have someone at a junior level being able to do that advocacy. One, because it's cheaper than sending a senior. If you're sending a partner to a return of subpoena, it's broadly a waste of your client's money. And two, it's a good way to meet people, different partners around the firm and develop that trust. And it's certainly what happened with me. And it's the way that, you know, I developed a lot of trust from a lot of senior practitioners in this firm. So it's a good core skill to have, and it goes beyond the realm of just advocacy.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation with lots of pearls of wisdom for those listening. Hugh Smith, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jerome. Cheers.
And James Dapperchy, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Jerome. Thanks for having us.
And thank you to the listener for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating and review on whatever platform you use to listen to podcasts, as it'll help other junior lawyers discover and enjoy this show. And if you've got ideas for other episodes we can run, please get in touch at editor@lawyersweekly.com.au. You can also reach us on social media. See you again next time.
Are you an in-house counsel seeking to keep ahead of the curve on the latest in industry shifts? Would you like to enhance your technical knowledge and establish yourself as an authoritative voice in your business? Look no further. The Lawyers Weekly Corporate Counsel Summit, coming to Sydney in May 2023, has been designed for this exact purpose, with sessions curated straight off the back of feedback from in-house counsel just like you. Learn how to engage management and stakeholders, delivering your strategic advice succinctly and with impact. Learn about the latest across ESG compliance and legislation, your role within cybersecurity, and how to engage internal teams to bolster your data protection, selecting a legal panel that aligns with your business's core values, and much, much more. Are you keen? Visit corporatecouncilsummit.com.au to learn more about the event and the expert speaker lineup and to secure your ticket.